Awakening Bodhi Mind, we are one Bodhi Mind. Arousing the unsurpassed mind, we are one unsurpassed mind. This is Dogen's verse for arousing the great vow of bodhicitta. One of Dogen Zenji's many expressions. Our theme for this week, arousing the mind of awakening. In this expression, Dogen says, we vow with all beings from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith, and that upon meeting it, we shall renounce worldly affairs, all that which distracts us from this Bodhi mind, and maintain the Buddha Dharma. And that in doing so, the great earth and all living beings together attain the Buddha way. So there it is, complete. The vow to open to the Buddha Dharma and awaken clear, compassionate mind. And then in doing so, all living beings together realize the Buddha way. So that's Dogen's Zen expression of bodhicitta, which breaks down that separation between first I will realize Buddhahood and then I will walk down the mountain and start saving all beings. This is more like at the moment of realizing the Buddha Dharma, all living beings together realize the Buddha way. Maybe a little bit like the boat pilot. Together we cross the shore. How could it be a matter of who goes first? So to review a little bit about bodhicitta, the altruistic mind, the wish to realize complete freedom and awakening only in order to benefit all beings and help everyone be free and awake. As I mentioned yesterday, these two aspects. One is great compassion, the wish that all beings be free from suffering. Traditionally part of bodhicitta. It's born from this wish that all beings be free, and we want this so badly that I personally will do whatever it takes to help all beings be free, that kind of compassion. But that's not the whole story. Then it's also the realization that in order to help all beings realize complete awakening, we must realize complete awakening. So it's the vow to free all beings from suffering and the wish that they be free, and the vow to realize great awakening in order to help them. My teacher one time was kind of checking this out with people, of how they felt about this bodhicitta and the bodhisattva path, and he said people often would understand it like, it just means being at the heart of great compassion that wants everyone to be free. I'm totally up for that. And then he said, what about becoming a Buddha? And people would say, well, I don't know if I'm up for that part. I said, well, that's really, it's both these sides, great compassion and this realization of awakening, only to benefit them. So we also have this one, two types of bodhicitta, the relative and the ultimate. The relative or conventional bodhicitta is the includes both the intention, which is the wish, intention, aspiration, to free all beings from suffering, and realize Buddha's way. And then the application, the putting it into effect. So sometimes it's broken, the relative bodhicitta is broken into these two parts of the aspiration and the intention. Yes, I'm clarifying this more and more deeply. This is what I want to do with my life. And then the application is, and here goes. Or like, you know, the intention to drive to San Francisco, and then actually getting in the car and turning on the engine and taking off. So both are important. You might say, well, do we really, I think this came up a little bit in our discussions. How much is the intention even that important? Once we have the basic idea, then isn't it just like, let's just go. Let's just moment to moment do it and not think about this big picture. And I think that's a good point to question. But in this analogy of driving to San Francisco, it might be like, oh yeah, we decided we're going to go, we get in the car, we're going, and then we're just totally present, we're just going moment by moment. We forget where we're even going. It doesn't matter because we're on the road and we're feeling fine. And here we go. And but meanwhile, we're maybe taking all these wrong turns and getting totally lost. Well, I thought I was going to San Francisco. We've realized when we're like in some back alley in Pescadero. Yes, Lynette.
Well, I totally disagree. Well, here's my thinking, and just chanting this, I mean, it's the heart of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But if I am, to me, the phrase that really resonates here is maintain the Buddha Dharma. If I am in my car and I am maintaining the Buddha Dharma on every moment, how can I get lost? I mean, it's like maybe we've painted a false picture by kind of separating the big picture out. You know what I mean? Maybe that's kind of a false dichotomy to separate out the big picture from our moment to moment actualizing our intention.
Maybe we could also just say it's just checking in from time to time with the intention, which would be like checking the GPS once in a while. But maybe not constantly though. I think it's not a matter of constantly, you know, when you're like, I'm going to serve this oryoki meal with total wholeheartedness and just give this food to these people. What a great spirit, and all these Buddha names are being chanted, and we're like in the flow of that dynamic activity, right? It's beautiful. I think it's not appropriate at that time to be like, oh yeah, why am I doing this again? Oh yeah, to benefit beings. Why am I doing this? To become a Buddha. It's like, we don't think about that at the time. We're just immersed in the activity, wholeheartedly doing it. But then it might be like, sometimes we might feel like, you know, now I'm just going through the motions. I think we all sometimes feel this way in the routine of a Zen center. It's like we're just doing the daily practice. We're going through it, but it's losing its life. We're just like, you know what I mean, by going through the motions. We're following the schedule, But we've forgotten in our heart. Maybe we've forgotten. What am I doing this again? I'm just like dragging my body in here one more time because I'm supposed to. Right? You know, that's when we're like in a back alley in Pescadero.
Isn't that how our suffering kind of serves as our GPS corrector? It's like, whoa, wrong turn because my mind and body, because I'm suffering.
Yeah, so we could say because we're suffering, and then we might be like, so why am I suffering? Well, what's happening here? I don't know, I'm just suffering. I guess it just keeps going until it ends. I'll just ride it out. Or that might be a way. I mean, I do that sometimes because I'm not that conscious. If I notice it, then I start reflecting and reminding myself, what am I doing again? And I think that's the aspiration part. What am I, oh yeah, actually, like when I review bodhicitta aspiration, I'm like, that is so amazing, that is so inspiring. I forgot all about it. I've totally lost track of it. Now I'm back on board by this. It's kind of conceptual thought. That's why it's called a relative bodhicitta. So I think it may be different at different times and for different of us how much we do that. So I think it's a good point that it's not a matter of all the time. Sometimes we're just immersed. And the traditional way of the application, the actual getting in the car and driving, is this practice of the six paramitas, which is just a daily thing. We might not even think that, which one am I working on now? It's like we just are practicing giving or patience or diligence or whatever. But I personally, maybe just because the way my mind works, I like to check in with that and kind of review the six paramitas on a daily basis, and like thinking, I'm really into like the maybe the precepts part, but like the patience part, actually, like I forgot all about that today. So just like we recite the Bodhisattva precepts as a kind of reminder of like, oh yeah, I forgot about this one since last month. So we keep doing it. It's conventional, somewhat contrived practice, but I think to arouse the aspiration is like a fuel for, an inspiration to get in the car and go. Because sometimes it's like, why would I want to drive to San Francisco? I'm fine just sitting here. And then we like think of how great San Francisco is, maybe, and we're like, oh, I'm gonna go now. Let's do it. So these are some of the ways of thinking about those two sides. It's just a way of talking about two sides. In Zen, maybe we say it's all combined as one practice, one vow. Yes, Richard. Well, I think this is a way, right? It's like remembering our true aspiration, going back to our deepest intention. And we have all these, you know, teachings about bodhicitta, and you can, like, for example, you could read the Ehe Koso Hotsu Ganmon of Dogen. Sometimes if you read that with like an open heart, if you have enough openness to like, I gotta try something, I'll read it and really pay attention. For me, it's like a very inspiring expression of Dogen, and sometimes inspiring is like, you know, relighting our Dharma candle. So that, you know, it's kind of consciously looking at our intention and aspiration, which we probably forgot. At the time, we feel like we're just going through the motions. Sometimes I like doing it, you know. I easily get into ruts of just going through the motions. So I like, you know, thinking actually about this aspiration again and again and again, and kind of, and also by thinking about it again and again, it starts to permeate our body and mind experience, so that we don't have to consciously keep bringing it up quite as much. Becomes like more and more natural. It's a mind training. Yes?
Yeah, I think I might be asking you to clarify what a Buddha is and what a Bodhisattva is. And then I've asked him this way, maybe a couple of months ago, you said something about your teacher Red saying to you, you need to go, or why don't you go the other 5% or 10% or something. Does this ring a bell to anybody else and to you?
I don't remember about...
And you said something like you didn't want to, you were reluctant to go that little percentage.
Are you sure it was me?
Huh?
Sure, isn't it? Maybe.
Were you referring to?
I'm wondering what that little percent was.
Does Rob remember?
I might be at, huh?
The only thing that I'm thinking of is when I think he asked you, "Are you willing to give up? Are you ready to give up everything?" I don't know if that's the same.
It could be the same.
It might have been, I remember a time when I think it was contemplating priest ordination. And you know, I think at one point he said, maybe I asked, like, what does this ordination really mean? It's like, something like, well, it means if you're a priest, you should be willing to give up everything. Doesn't necessarily mean that you do, but you should be willing to. And I was like, oh, well, then never mind. let me contemplate that for a while. I'm not ready to say yes to that right now. I think it was probably like, he probably said it like that, and I said, okay, I'm thinking about that. I thought about it for a long time, and really, like, took it seriously. Like, what does that mean? Like, that's an incredibly frightening thought, it felt like. And
what's a Buddha and what's a Bodhisattva?
Anyway, just about to finish the story about the give up everything. I remember contemplating it a lot, and one day I felt like this actually readiness, and I felt it was very fragile. I felt like tomorrow, I don't know if I could feel this again, but in this moment, I actually feel like that willingness. I was probably thinking about, like, am I ready to die? If it was like, could I give away my actual life? And I thought, right now, just for this one moment, I'm feeling inspired enough to say that. And so I felt like it's not going to last, maybe. So I went right away to his cabin on a day off at Tassajara and knocked on his door. And it's kind of like his personal time, you know. So he's like, yes. And I, like, walked in the door and, like, threw myself on the floor in a prostration. And said, I'm willing to give up everything now. And he was like, didn't know what to say. It was not. I think he said, and then I was like, there was a long silence, and I said, so what should I do now? I'm kind of like, here I am, I'm ready. Just tell me, if you want, tell me to die, I'm ready to die. And he said, well, why don't you just walk that way? I said, yes. Now I have the difference between a Buddha and a Bodhisattva. So I didn't look up.
Did you do it that day, or did you have to wait?
No, after he asked, you mean? No, I think it was like months.
No, I mean,
later.
After you did the whole process, was it that day that you were ordained?
No, I think. No, but I think that was maybe a turning point for me. Like, I feel like now, I feel after a long time of contemplating this and other points, I felt, okay, I feel ready. And then maybe I even said more specifically in a later meeting, like, I feel ready to do this. And then he said, okay, thank you for letting me know. Now he'll see if he's ready. So it's a kind of a mutual thing like that. It wasn't like he was like, as soon as you're ready, we're going to do it. It's more like, oh, thank you for now your side is complete, and now let me see, check out my side. I didn't look at this only in a Buddha and a Buddha that Raoul mentioned, where it might say something like Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are no difference. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if Dogen says that. But I think it's in here. This is Hotsu Bodaishin, not the essay that we're studying, but the other arousing bodhicitta essay of Dogen. Find it at this time. Oh, here it is. Clearly remember, I just bought a light cause Tanahashi's translation, but it was too thick a book to put in my pile here. So, Nishijima Roshi, who translated this, just died about a week ago or so. So this is a good reminder about bodhicittas. Great teachers are constantly dying. So something like, to awaken bodhicitta is inevitably seen as foremost. This is the eternal rule of the Buddhas and ancestors. To awaken means to be clear in it. It does not refer to the great realization of the truth itself. I think Kaz's translation makes this even more clear, but it's something like to arouse. This is the word he's saying. Hotsu is the word for awaken here. To generate or arouse. This mind means to be clear about bodhicitta. It does not refer to the great realization of truth itself. In this essay, he's saying this. Other places, Dogen will say otherwise, but he's saying, here bodhicitta just means to be clear about our aspiration. It doesn't mean actual realization itself. Even those who have suddenly experienced these 10 bodhisattva stages are still bodhisattvas. The 28 ancestors of India, the 6 ancestors of China, and all other great ancestral masters are bodhisattvas. They are not Buddhas. So, and they're not Shravakas, Prajeka Buddhas, or the like, either. They're bodhisattvas. Among practitioners of this age, there's not one person who clearly knows that these ancestors are bodhisattvas and not shravakas. So, here, I guess really the point was more that the Zen ancestors are not Buddhas. So I think sometimes we can find different ways of saying this, but I was surprised to find Dogen being that explicit in saying these Buddha ancestors are bodhisattvas on the path to Buddhahood, and they're not Buddhas yet, but they're going in that direction, which is kind of a traditional view. But Zen likes to break through traditional views and say, that the Buddha ancestors are Buddha ancestors. So you find both sides. I mean, Dogen calls his own teacher old Buddha, Tian Tong, Ru Jing. But you know, in this case, he's according with more like the Indian Mahayana tradition, where the bodhisattvas are strictly speaking, it's nice to know the kind of traditional take. So the traditional thing is, officially, a bodhisattva is one who's kind of like spontaneously and effortlessly given rise to this bodhicitta, the aspiration to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings, which I say spontaneously and naturally, because usually it's a matter of with great kind of effort and kind of contrived intention for a long, long time. One meditates on, I wish to do this. I'm generating this thought. I'm making this vow again and again. But you know, strictly speaking, they're not exactly a bodhisattva yet, until the actual that intention, that aspiration now arises, like, no longer contrived. It's no longer like, I'm trying, I think it's a good idea, I'm trying. It sounds like, it's like on this shift of mind of like, there's no doubt anymore, this is what I'm doing, and I'm willing to give up everything to do it. And it's like, it's a moment of maybe inspiration. And that's one way of talking about a bodhisattva is born at that time. And another way of talking about it is like, they have this great compassionate wish like this, combined with like a direct realization of emptiness. So when these 10 bodhisattva stages, they enter the first stage called the extremely joyful. These stages have different names. The first is called extreme joy, which is when they have this compassionate, selfless wish that's maybe, we could say, conjoined with the realization of emptiness. Like the Diamond Sutra says, the bodhisattva has this mind that wishes to free all beings and sees that there aren't any beings at the same time. So that would be another kind of classic definition of when the bodhisattva enters the first bhumi. They're sometimes it's even called change of lineage. They become like a noble one, born as a bodhisattva, and they actually are irreversible at that point, but then there's still kind of eons of practice to go before realizing Buddhahood, which would be like, as we talked about yesterday, it's like the realization of emptiness and non-duality on the first bhumi, the first bodhisattva stage, is the same realization of as a Buddha. So actually, their insight into emptiness does not actually improve over these 10 bodhisattva bhumis. But what it does is like stabilize, because the first one is just like a glimpse. And then by Buddha, it's like continuously coursing in emptiness as part of it. And then also, there's all kinds of refinements of what happens between like the 10th bodhisattva stage and Buddhahood. Again, this is like, you know, Indian Mahayana Buddhism is very complex, and like Zen is kind of like likes to just not get into any of that, all these steps and stages and progression, and it's kind of like, let's just cut through it all and just drop off body and mind here and now. But it's nice to know that I think Dogen was well aware of these traditional takes, and this is a case where he's kind of saying, maybe to his audience at that time, saying, we're all Buddhas, right? And he's saying, no, even all the great Zen ancestors were not Buddhas, strictly speaking, but they were bodhisattvas. So that's a little bit about that. Maybe we could also say, the bodhisattvas are developing these skillful means through these stages, but at Buddhahood, there's like infinite boundless skillful means, which would be like being able to, you know, read other people's minds to know exactly what they need in every situation to benefit them as efficiently and greatly as possible. And they're able to, like, you know, the amount that these three Buddha bodies that they manifest, they can manifest in these non, you know, like basically pure lands where they can be seen by these other bodhisattvas as Sambhogakaya Buddhas, to benefit beings who aren't even like in our sort of plane of reality, and they can manifest like transformation bodies on earth too. So these are like kind of cosmic stories, right? But this is part of the tradition that bodhisattvas can't yet like manifest these Sambhogakaya bodies. I think it's beautiful. I you know, as you can probably tell, I love, you know, the vastness of our tradition, especially the cosmic Mahayana mind-blowing vision of what's possible in this life. And even if it's just a bunch of very creative, imaginative people letting their imaginations run wild, I appreciate their... I think they were inspired to come up with this stuff. And I'm also greatly inspired by Zen. It's like, let's not get distracted by all of these stories from our work at hand of just being right here now and letting go of everything. Yes.
Well, you just said two things that I totally respect you and love you for. your great interest and admiration in the sort of, I would almost say, scholarly interest in all this Buddhist history and color and thought and imagination. And then almost in the next sentence we say, and I love the simplicity of dropping that and starting to think about one finger Zen.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you can have both.
Oh, I think maybe not at the same time, the same moment, but, you know, Sachin is a nice time to experience one finger Zen, and then in between sessions, I have this vast library of these texts that actually, you know, it inspires me. It's not just accumulating knowledge. Sometimes I can get into that kind of mode, but that's, I think, kind of a waste of time. But as inspiration, it turns my mind of like, this is, I can get into a very kind of limited, little view of like, even one finger Zen, this is a little thing we're doing here. When I read those sutras and stuff, it's like, oh no, this is big. It's bigger than, it's beyond big and small. It's, you know, it's, mostly I'm drawn to all those kind of teachings for inspiration. I would say it's, rather than like trying to learn something even, it's more like, it, for my type of personality, whatever, it greatly inspires me, meaning like it fuels my aspiration to keep practice more deeply. Maybe that's part of the thing with Zen can sometimes, if it seems too simple, it's like, well, there's no, it's just about being here now. This is just very, you know.
Well,
and then,
that's
it.
The paradox is just never end for me, and then it's a question of even discussing aspiration or intention when we also discuss the idea that the minute you sit down to sit seiza with any intention, you defeat the whole purpose. I mean,
any intention defeats just doing.
To accomplish anything or get anything or to be a Buddha. If you're working hard and inspired, ready to give everything up to be a Buddha, that's a gigantic intention that I think goes directly against what Zen talks about.
Zen is filled with intention. We just chanted Dogen's vow, intention vow, right? So there's a lot of that.
Well, that's...
But at the moment, let's say, at the moment of just sitting, if we're practicing Shikantaza, that's about, I would say, we're at the time of Shikantaza, we drop away all intention. But we're not always practicing Shikantaza, right?
As we know.
Yeah, so sometimes our practice, I would say, is cultivating the intention, and sometimes is dropping off the intention.
I have to agree with that. This is the contradictions come on.
So continuing with this, this brings up this point about these two types of bodhicitta, relative and ultimate, right? Which is what we get into today. So relative, as we've been talking about, is this relative or conventional, is this, both the aspiration and then the setting out on the path of this, of the six paramitas. Both the intention and the application aspects are relative bodhicitta, and they're produced with the support of thought.
Are you on the...
No, this is like, this is Patil Rinpoche.
Oh.
Through training for a long time in relative bodhicitta, on the paths of accumulating and preparation, this is part of the Bodhisattva path story, you come at last to the path of seeing or direct insight, where you have real experience of thusness, the natural state of all things. This is wisdom beyond all elaboration, the truth of emptiness. At that time you arouse ultimate bodhicitta, which is wisdom with no thought movement. So that's a little bit like Richard's, I think, maybe more inspired by the ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom with no thought. But this take on bodhicitta says, for a long time practicing the relative bodhicitta, the aspiration to realize emptiness for the benefit of all beings, then one realizes it, and that's the shift from relative bodhicitta to ultimate bodhicitta. So that pair of these two types of bodhicitta, let's now hear first the Diamond Sutra. You heard this yesterday, this part about all these bodhisattvas should produce a thought like this, right? All these beings born in, from eggs and wombs and so on, right? I will lead them all to nirvana. So it's like, that's, I would think, kind of a relative bodhicitta thought. I'm making this conceptual mind aspiration. And by the way, there's no beings there. But It's including all these beings in the thought. So it's kind of a relative bodhicitta teaching of the Buddha, with a little bit of ultimate in there, tagged on at the end. By the way, there aren't any beings. But then later in the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says to Subhuti, again, the bodhisattva should produce this kind of thought. So I propose an ultimate bodhicitta teaching. The bodhisattva should produce an unsupported thought, a thought which is nowhere supported by sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or mind objects. So a free thought with no object or motive at all. I think that's what Richard's talking about, right? No motive or intention even. And the Buddha does teach that bodhisattvas should produce that kind of thought also. So are these contradictory? I would say sometimes they arouse their aspiration to save all beings, and sometimes they produce an unsupported thought, or another translation of that is they give rise to the mind of no abode. We have this place, No Abode Hermitage, that's named partly after this section of the Diamond Sutra. This is also the section of the Diamond Sutra that the sixth ancestor of Zen, when walking through the marketplace one day before he started practicing Zen, he overheard somebody in the marketplace reciting the Diamond Sutra, and it was this section, supposedly. He heard somebody's, maybe like, as they're waiting for customers at the farmer's market, they're like reading the sutra out loud. You could do this, Chuck.
I love it when that happens.
Bodhisattva should give rise to the mind of no abode. And meanwhile, little Hui Nung was shopping for apples. And he just happened to be walking by that farm stand. And Chuck was reciting the sutra like that, and his little mind went, ding, whoa, who said, what? Thought of no abode, and he had some opening, enough of an opening, and he's like, actually, forget the apples. I gotta go find a Zen teacher in place right away. And he did. So that's the other, that's like an ultimate bodhicitta teaching from the Diamond Sutra that goes along with the relative bodhicitta teaching of as many beings as there are born in all these different ways, I vow to lead them all to nirvana. Now we have Dogen Zenji. We better not forget him because this is a Genzoe Sesshin. So he's got these two fascicles, ones that we have here called Hotsu Mujo Shin, arousing the unsurpassed mind. Hotsu means like generating, arousing, giving rise to, awakening. We could even say like emanating, radiating the unsurpassed mind. This is when you look up Hotsu in the Japanese dictionary. Sending out, disclosing, revealing the unsurpassed mind. But generally it's used to translate this cittutpada, bodhicittutpada, which means like generating, giving rise to, establishing the mind of awakening. And apparently Dogen wrote these two essays, both called Hotsu Bodaishin, giving rise to bodhicitta, on the same day, or he presented them anyway on the same day in 1244, when he was 44 years old. And they're completely different. Sometimes Dogen has two essays with the same title, or there are a couple with the same title that have a lot of overlap, as if he sort of started, he wrote a draft and then revised it partially. But in this case, there's no overlap at all. They're completely different discussions about bodhicitta. And in the fall this year, we'll do a class on Hotsu Bodaishin, the other essay. They're both really beautiful, I think. So later, people renamed this one Hotsu Mujoshin just to keep it from confusing the two. It is a traditional way of talking about bodhicitta is mujoshin, or literally it's like nothing, those characters there, mu is like no or nothing, and that one that's the upright thing means like above or upper or above, so like literally it's like nothing above mind, or we translate as unsurpassed. Or supreme, nothing above it, mind or heart, Hotsu Mujoshin. And this was after Dogen left Kyoto due to various political controversies and so on, and went to the mountains to establish a Heiji. A donor had given this land, so they were going to build a new temple in the mountains. And the Dogen and a few of the monks were living in, I think, a small hermitage or another small temple at the bottom of the mountain or nearby on that land or nearby that land while they were building. And this was just like, you know, we know the date. Dogen dates all these things, so something like 5 days before they did a groundbreaking ceremony to start building a Heiji. Yeah, the groundbreaking ceremony was 5 days later. And so this is taught at Kipoji, which is this little temple, during the building time. Dogen wrote a whole bunch, it seems, during this time, around this 1244. Another part of the story is that there were all these workers around, construction workers about to build the temple, and that one theory is that this essay, Hotsu Mujoshin, was given for the construction workers. Like, they wanted a Dharma talk, you know. And the Hotsu Bodaishin was given for the monks at the who were living at the temple there with him. So I think that the modern scholar in Japan who came up with that theory felt like this is more about more directed towards lay people, and it actually talks a lot about building projects, right? It's like how the merit of building temples and is a type of bodhicitta, whereas the other one is more about leaving home and so on. But if you get into them, you find a lot of, I don't know if you can break it down that simply, but they do have these different themes. But what I noticed is when we talk about this relative and ultimate bodhicitta, and I look at these two essays, and Jerry brought this up yesterday, is like, when I read this, where's the compassion part in here? And I thought, yeah, it's not even really mentioned. But the other one is a lot about compassion, or a lot about helping others first to realize the way. So I would classify these two essays as Hotsu Bodaishin, the one we'll study this fall, is more like a relative bodhicitta teaching about the intentional aspiration to help all beings and really emphasizing others first, and gives a lot of practices to do that. And this one is more like an ultimate bodhicitta of the mind of no abode, is as bodhicitta, or the mind of no abode gives rise to bodhicitta, and it's all about the unconditioned. And even actions like building temples are unconditioned, unproduced activities, as we'll see here in this essay. So I think it's, to look at it like that, I think is quite beautiful, because it's like maybe Dogen wrote one of them and felt like this is maybe just the ultimate side, or he wrote the other one and this is just the relative side. Let's write a whole other one about the ultimate bodhicitta. But they're both about bodhicitta. So in that way it fits very nicely into this tradition of these two aspects of the conventional and the ultimate. Yes.
So supposing you could meet somebody that had a mind of no abode, would they be able to help somebody in a way that we consider conventional,
It's kind of. So that's. Yeah, so that's part of the story about this thing about bodhisattvas and Buddhas, is that one way we could say it is like bodhisattvas do this. It's a little bit like this conversation with Richard. Like I kind of see it like bodhisattvas kind of alternate. They have these two different aspects of their practice. One is just like according with living beings in the conventional world and helping in all kinds of conventional ways where you might not even notice that they're a bodhisattva. just whatever helps in the conventional world. And then sometimes they secretly go to the Zendo and they drop off body and mind, enter the mind of no abode, let go of all kinds of grasping, to even grasping ideas of helping beings, and then they go back and help beings. So they kind of alternate back and forth, and the letting go and the Zendo helps them to help beings conventionally in a more free way, not get too caught up in that. And the helping beings in the conventional world helps them not fall into just like some kind of stagnation of stillness, of emptiness. So they're kind of going back and forth like that, and there may be the way that those influence each other becomes more and more harmonious. And in fact, I think we probably all have some experience somewhat like this, and that's probably why we come to practice here, because it does affect our daily life, right? It's like you come to Zazen, and then I'm not saying necessarily Zazen's like realizing emptiness completely, but there's some correlation here. I think it nourishes us deeply and puts everything in a different perspective. And then we go back into our busy life and help beings, and then we start to get tired, and then we come back, so we come back for Zazen, and back and forth like that. I think that's Bodhisattva path. And then as they progress in these Bodhisattvas towards Buddhahood, maybe there's less and less difference between helping beings and Zazen, until at Buddhahood, part of the definition of a Buddha, sorry, Jeff's gone, because this is maybe part of a traditional understanding here that's a little different, is that these two truths, right, that the Bodhisattvas realize the ultimate truth in meditation, mostly when they're not doing anything, because that's the easiest, when you're not, don't have to do anything, maybe we could say, you just let go, and in Zazen, and then back and forth. But the Buddha is these two truths, of the ultimate truth of emptiness, where nothing's arising and ceasing, and the conventional truth of arising and ceasing, living beings and suffering and all kinds of everything. These two are united for a Buddha. They're simultaneous. So their Bodhisattvas are alternating. And my teacher sometimes says that, like, as the Bodhisattvas progress, it's like they're kind of like back and forth, like a pendulum back and forth between, like, you can see the meditative equipoise of resting in emptiness, and then the work of the first five paramitas in the world, practicing generosity and so on. And then they're vibrating back and forth more and more, like, quickly between these, till it's like a vibration, till it's like the difference between these two is like becomes less and less. And a Buddha, it's like the vibration is just like it's like you can't there's no difference anymore between the relative conventional truth and the ultimate truth of emptiness.
How close is the Buddha to the Tao?
The Buddha is the Tao.
Then the Buddha is impossible to talk about.
Yeah, so this is a sort of a lame attempt at talking about the Buddha, this non-duality of the two truths is actually impossible to talk about. Because you could say, how can you realize that there's nothing happening at the same time everything's happening, and you really like completely are immersed in both? I mean, we might say, well, we always are immersed in both, but this would be like the full realization of both.
Then you're the source.
Yeah, the source. And I think it's true that to talk about that, they say, how is it that you can have the conventional and the ultimate truths united simultaneously? Well, it's inconceivable to us. It actually doesn't make any sense. No. You can't talk about it in a rational way.
But we do.
Yeah, I mean, we have that story, and maybe it's a nice story to point at the inconceivability of Buddha. You could say, well, how is it that the Buddha is inconceivable? Well, he's completely immersed in the two truths at the same time. That's why the Buddha is inconceivable. So, one thing in this Hotsu Mujoshin is that we're going to hear that the mind of wood and stone gives rise to bodhicitta, which is like a Zen sort of poetic way of saying the mind that's where like nothing's happening, like the stillness of stone and wood, that kind of like non-discriminating mind, like wood and stone. So that mind gives rise to bodhicitta in this essay, Hotsumu Joshin. And then I thought this was really, nobody made this comments in these commentaries, but comparing these, I thought this is uncanny how this one, Hotsubo Daishin, Dogen says, there's these three kinds of mind. One is called citta, which he calls the thinking mind, thinking or discriminating mind. And then the second, hridaya, which usually means like heart, is called the mind of grass and trees. And then there's this third mind too. And he's saying, which mind do you arouse bodhicitta with? He says, you arouse bodhicitta with the thinking, discriminating mind, not the mind of grass and trees, which is sort of like, I hear grass and trees is like wood and stone. So, and again, I propose that Hotsubo Daishin is talking about these compassionate conventional practices, but Dogen saying bodhisattvas are not Buddhas, and he's saying you arouse bodhicitta with your thinking, discriminating mind. A little bit unusual for Dogen, maybe, right? Whereas this week's essay, Hotsumu Joshin, you arouse bodhicitta with the non-discriminating wood and stone mind. So again, this supports this view that Hotsumu Joshin is like an ultimate bodhicitta teaching. It's not about discriminating mind, which is very appropriate that we are taking up this one in Sesshin, and the other one would be a class, or we can just get totally into discrimination.
You would think that, the construction workers would resonate more with wood and stone.
Because they're working with wood and stone.
That's something they know.
Good point. Yeah, maybe that's part of why he's talking about building stupas and Buddha images with the mind of wood and stone. Yeah, that's a nice point. I don't think anybody else picked up on that one either. Yeah, exactly. Just the activity, working with wood and stone. The high ancestor of India, Shakyamuni Buddha, or the eminent ancestor, it's actually this term, Koso, that we use in the Ehe Koso Hotsuganmon, which is like used often for Dogen, eminent ancestor Dogen, but Dogen's here saying the eminent ancestor of India, Shakyamuni Buddha, said, the snow mountains, the Himalayas, which is a, snow mountains is a way of, in Chinese, of saying Himalayas, are like great nirvana. You know, alaya. You know what alaya means? Alaya in Sanskrit. Alaya vijnana. You know what it means? Anyone in English? Alaya vijnana. Storehouse consciousness. So it's, you know, it's a part of the Yogacara school. But this word alaya literally means storehouse or container. And Himal means snow. So in India, there's a modern state called Himal Pradesh, which is this like snowy province in the north. So Himal alaya is the storehouse of snow. The Himalaya mountains are they're the giant storehouse of pure white snow. And they're like great nirvana. And then Dogen says, no, this is a precise analogy, intimate and direct. Another translation, this seems to be a funny section here. know that this is a precise analogy, since both are intimate and direct. Both snow mountains and nirvana are intimate and direct. That's why the snow mountains are like great nirvana. To take up the snow mountains is to speak of the snow mountains. Or, you could translate, to take up the snow mountains is like snow mountains. To take up great nirvana is like great nirvana. So, I don't know exactly what Dogen's doing there, but if he quotes something, he has to make a comment on it. So, the snow mountains are like great nirvana. I just, a couple weeks ago, was around those Himalaya snow mountains, and Shoho's rooftop apartment on the clear days. The Kathmandu Valley is surrounded by, it's a big, used to be a lake, big flat, a plain, you know, 20, 40 miles diameter, large plain surrounded by mountains, and then in the, but not that big mountains. And then in the distance, you see the big snow mountains of the Himalaya. It's always so moving to me, because the mountains that you see are like Tassajara kind of mountains from the valley. They already look pretty big. And then when you see in the distance, which is 50 miles away, something really far, but they're so much higher, right? And they're steep peaks. And something that's moving about the big snow mountains, right? And even more when you fly into or out of Kathmandu Valley, that's when you get the really good view. If you're on the right side of the airplane, our pilgrimage group basically had a whole airplane to ourselves as we flew from Kathmandu to Lumbini, tiny propeller plane with 20 of us. And so we could kind of like walk around to the other side of the plane and look at the other people's windows. And almost like it's one of those times that unconsciously like tears would come to my eyes seeing those kind of mountains. I don't know what it is. Just the majestic vastness. So huge, right? And the tallest part of Earth in the world, right, is the Mount Everest right there. So I think this is something of this statement here. The snow mountains, the big, majestic, still, pure, white, shining mountains are like great nirvana. Very lofty, steep, pure, unmoving. Nothing's happening up there, but just the upright stillness of vast spaciousness. This is like great nirvana. Bodhidharma, the first ancestor of China, said, mind is like wood and stone. I think very similar. The snow mountains are like great nirvana, the nirvanic aspect of mind. Nirvana means total stillness and peace. And the mind, or we might say the nature of mind, truly is like wood and stone. So this is coming from Baijan. Dogen's quoting this from, he doesn't say so, but he's quoting our Chinese Zen ancestor Baijan. And this is the larger passage of Baijan talking here. Right now, and this was a while ago, but I think actually he's talking about right now.
Right now.
Right now. Right now, if your mind is like empty space, for the first time your study has some accomplishment. An eminent ancestor in India said, the Himalaya is compared to great nirvana. The first ancestor in China, Bodhidharma, said, mind and mental conditions like wood or stone. And then he goes on. The third ancestor said, immobile, forgetting conditions. The sixth ancestor said, do not think good or bad at all. My late master Matsu said, be like a lost person, unable to tell your whereabouts. Huh? Where am I? I don't know if it's Pescadero or San Francisco or where it is. I'm just here. We say no reference points. Master Sung Zhao said, cutting off knowledge, blocking conceptions, solitary awareness, something obscure and unfathomable. Manjushri said, that's right. And then later he said, mind is like empty space. Therefore, respectful obeisance has nothing to look upon. Or maybe like prostrations to Buddha are prostrating to empty space. The most profound scripture is neither heard nor accepted and upheld. I think that's referring to the verse that's been chanted since ancient times. The unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect Dharma is rarely met with. Now, having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words, we chant. So here he's playing with this. And the most profound sutra, or perfect Dharma, is not, we don't have to see and listen to remember and accept, actually. Then, so Bhajan quotes all these ancient Zen ancestors, and then he says, right now, if you don't see or hear anything at all, existent or not, your six sense faculties shut off. If you can study in this way, if you can uphold the scripture in this way, then for the first time you have some accomplishment in practice. And he says, these words may actually offend your ears and pain my mouth. But still. And then later someone asks, what is the essential method for sudden awakening in the great vehicle? Are you wondering about this? Give it to me straight, Bhajan. Here it is. Bhajan said, you should first put an end to all involvements and lay to rest all concerns. Do not remember or recollect anything at all, whether good or bad, mundane or transcendental. Do not engage in thoughts. Let go of body and mind. Set them free. Sounds like it's straight out of the Fukan Zazengi. Maybe there are some actually quotes there. Let go of body and mind, set them free. With mind like wood or stone, not explaining anything with the mouth, mind not going anywhere, then the mind ground becomes like space, wherein the sun of wisdom naturally appears. It is as though the clouds had opened and the sun emerged. That's the essential method for sudden awakening in the Mahayana. Want to hear again? You should first put an end to all involvements and lay to rest all concerns. Or our translation says, put aside all involvements and cease all affairs. Do not think good or bad. Do not administer pros and cons in our Fukan Zengi. Don't even think of the transcendental, not to mention the mundane. Do not engage in thoughts. Let go of body and mind. Set them free. With a mind like wood or stone, not going anywhere, the ground of mind, the nature of mind becomes like space, is like space, but we open to its space-like quality, wherein the sun of wisdom naturally appears as though the clouds had opened and the sun emerged. Beautiful Zazen instructions for
session. But it sounds like something that you could only accomplish in a monastic setting.
I don't know if it needs any particular setting, but a Zendo is designed for such practice.
Well, in my monastery, you have a whole life that, you know, from up in the morning to sleep at night.
That sounds familiar. Don't we have that?
We have it for 5 days.
So let's take full advantage of it. But you're right. Baijiang was talking to mountain monks in the monastery, I think. And it's hard at different times and places. But we have the ideal conditions. And it's possible anywhere to just drop into being, and the more we sit in with the support of the prime conditions of the Zendo, with Sangha sitting together quietly and a good place that's designed for that. The more we do that, then the more we can maybe bring it into more difficult situations. That could be our aspiration if we're not too averse to having an aspiration.
I will concur that that has been a trip. That word, I don't.
Aspiration?
Yeah.
Well, then.
Desire is just completely coupled together with aspiration.
But it's not a self-centered desire.
Well, that's where it gets.
It's tricky. But since we're talking about aspiration directly, here's another word from Dogen, informally, before we end today. This is maybe about 10 years earlier, Dogen's informal talks. So they have a different flavor than the kind of literary, poetic quality of the Shobo Genzo. A student asked Dogen, "Although many years have passed since aspiring to learn the way, I have not yet had any realization. Many of the ancient teachers said that the way does not depend on intelligence or being really wise or clever. Therefore, I don't think we should demean ourselves because of our inferior capacity. Is there something about this that's been handed down in the tradition which I should keep in mind?" Dogen instructed, "You are right about not relying on intelligence, talent, quick-wittedness, or cleverness, sharp mind in learning the way." I think Dogen was actually a pretty intelligent guy, right? Kind of a literary genius and stuff. So it's nice that he says, "That's right, you don't need that."
Those are the guys that say that.
It's sometimes true. You're right about you don't need special intelligence or something like that. But still, it's wrong to mistakenly encourage a person to become blind, deaf, or ignorant. Since studying the way does not require having wide knowledge or highly talented abilities, you should not show disdain toward anyone because of their inferior capacity. True practice of the way must be easy Nevertheless, even in the monasteries in Great Song, China, there are only one or two people out of several hundred or thousands of practitioners who realize the Dharma and attain the way in the assembly of one teacher. So this is like, we might say, well, I thought everybody realizes the way. So this is one side of Dogen, where he's saying only a few people get this. Therefore, there must be things handed down which we should keep in mind. I believe this. It depends only on whether one's aspiration is firmly determined or not. And I think this is a word that, as I recall in Japanese, is not Hotsu Bodaishin, or it's just a colloquial word that just means aspiration. A person who arouses true aspiration and studies or practices as hard as his capacity allows will not fail to attain the way. We have to be careful to concentrate on and directly carry out the following practice. First of all, just maintain the aspiration to earnestly seek the way. I know it's a little bit controversial, you know. We talk about way-seeking mind. I could look up later, but I think it's a different character that actually does mean something like seek or desire. So I think we have to be clear that this bodhicitta aspiration is not, although, as Rob's pointing out, it's very close to like ordinary self-centered seeking and striving. In this case, it's a very energetic movement, but with this aspiration to let go of ourself. It's this aspect of the self, we might say, that wants to get over itself. Or we might say that it's not even, this aspiration doesn't even come from the self. It's actually Buddha nature's knocking on the inside of our skull and saying like, hello, let me out of here, wake up. And so, and then we're like, and then that kind of, because it gets translated through our usual self conceptual mind, our little self says, I'm going to just go to the Zendo or the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. I will not rise from the seat until I realize the way. It's like, is that a self-centered striving? Kind of sounds like it.
Well, here's to that point. I suppose I've read in Vedic writings that desire is necessary. It's the manure, it's the fuel. Drives one ultimately to a realization. And you know, my thought is that I've experienced is you're climbing a mountain with the aspiration, let's make it the most almost negative, to be heroic and macho and to accomplish and conquer the mountain. And you do all this work for that. But when you get there and you see what you see, and this is that classic story, right? Now you see, now from all that work, you've gotten to a perspective where something you didn't expect, you now see and you now learn and you're different for it. So the whole journey was motivated by one thing, desire, but then a true learning happened because you followed it through.
Yeah, I think it often is that way. So you could say there's maybe a paradox in there. You have this, you seek and seek until the very end of all seeking. You seek to realize something and you think it's something that you're going to get, but in the end, it's not something that you get. It's the end of getting anything, and it's the end of all seeking.
Oh, it's the famous story of the journey from home, going through the whole journey and arriving home with the new knowledge.
Yeah. So then the question is, if we have some intuitive sense that that's the case, that we need to even bother with the journey, or, and especially like a really wholehearted journey that is only possible with a strong aspiration to do it? Or can we just say, I know that this leads to nothing, actually. It leads to right here. So then it seems like the aspiration thing is kind of like a little extra. It's kind of like, you know, what is that, that metaphor of like, you get the laundry dirty in order to wash it. So you could say, well, why not just leave the laundry clean in the beginning?
You can't do this.
Yeah, and maybe you can, I don't know. But it seems like there is this enactment of aspiration. But again, my understanding of bodhicitta is it's this unique kind of desire or aspiration that's that might start off self-centered, but as it grows and becomes more refined, it's a momentum, very maybe passionate and wholehearted, but it's not self-centered. It's not self-serving. But I think this is in our own practice is something we have to really check out, because it's always maybe going back and forth. There's like a true inspiration, and then we
ego-centric.
Yeah, the ego comes in. Like I think I maybe told this before, but I remember wanting to receive the precepts from my teacher in this Jukai ceremony, and I thought, well, this is something that people do, and it would be great to do, and I feel this connection with my teacher, and this is a way to, like, you know, kind of symbolically or deeper than symbolically make, you know, celebrate our connection and celebrate the devotion to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and feeling like this mix of like true inspiration that felt like this a very natural calling to do that. At the same time, this self-centered mind of like, well, but it'd be really cool, you know, you get a rakusu and get to join the club like that and stuff. And so mixed together, right? I felt there's some pure aspiration that really feels selfless. And it's all woven together with this kind of all this ego stuff. And I told him that. I'm like, I feel like I want to do this, but I actually hesitate. I think maybe I shouldn't, because I feel like there's, even though there's some true inspiration there, there's also this, you know, clingy sort of self-cherishing kind of thing mixed in. So maybe I should skip it. And he said, no, don't skip it, because your aspiration like that will never be completely pure until you're like a fully awakened Buddha, actually. See, if you have that, if you feel like you don't want to do anything until you're completely selfless, you'll never do anything. You won't be able to get out of bed in the morning or stay in bed or anything, right? Because it's always going to be this mix. So he says, go ahead, do it, because it's partly coming from this true aspiration. If it was a pure ego, still he might say, actually go ahead and do it, because then the process of doing it will purify your self-centeredness. But it's like, if it's this mix, go ahead and do it, and as you're doing it, try to, you know, let go of the self-centered part. And just, you know, emphasize or, you know, nourish the selfless aspiration part. I thought that was beautiful advice, I think, for any kind of practice that I think fits into our conversation about aspiration. To be honest with ourselves, there's always going to be some self-centered thing. Or even if it's pure, selfless act we might do, and then maybe somebody then praises us afterwards, and then the ego comes in like, oh really, I didn't even notice I did that. Oh, that is kind of nice. That's so good. So I'm like, oh, we ruined it. is very natural. But I think that's called being human. I think we always have that.
But you think at the same time, with the recognition through the realization that there is no ego there anyway.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Here comes the self-centered part. It's so sticky. I wish that part wasn't even there. And then there's some recognition where we can turn that with some insight and be like, oh, that's just like this ancient twisted pattern, of course, but it's not really like myself. I think that's when we maybe start to feel really guilty and ashamed of that is when we're maybe like solidifying the self too much. Like, oh, yeah, there is another like awkward mistake coming from this, you know, from this view of self that I don't really believe, but it's been operating for so many eons that of course it's got this momentum and it's going to keep going for a long time.
I wonder if in the Zvimakhi that you read there, if Dogen, when he talks about in some China there's only a couple people, that he's being critical of that particular practice that he encountered a lot of in China when he was there before his meeting with Ruijing. Because in a different place in the Zvimakhi there, where he is laying out practice and saying, if you proceed in this way, 9 out of 10 of you will realize the way.
And maybe even 10 out of 10.
Maybe it is.
Yeah, yeah. I recall that too, yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, the skillful means at different times, right? Maybe this...
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's what he's doing there.
I mean, this is the kind of like the steep wall side of Dogen, right? And yeah, you definitely find things, many places where Dogen says, all of you will realize the way. And he does say here, true practice of the way must be easy. And then right after that, maybe he sees everybody like, yes! And says, nevertheless, only one or two people out of thousands.
Well, I think that, you know, through his meeting with Ruijing and the understanding, probably from an intellectual standpoint and also an experiential standpoint of the dropping away of body and mind, he realized how simple that actually was, right?
Yeah.
And all of this other stuff that he'd been digging through for so long, where it was to come back and to kind of help other people not have to go through that process.
Yeah.
Just like, just do this.
Yeah.
It's really simple, actually.
It's really simple. Yeah, and yet it's hard because of our ancient twisted karma. It's not so easy to just, I mean, it is easy, right, from a certain perspective. And from the perspective of our usual mind, it seems not easy. So that's when you could say, as a skillful means, it could be, for people to say, it's not easy. Well, then just arouse this aspiration. If you just say, it's easy, just do it. Just let go. Well, that doesn't help. Sometimes it might, at a certain time and place, right? For example, a person who desires to steal a precious treasure or to beat a powerful enemy or win over a beautiful woman will constantly seek an opportunity while carrying out whatever activities in whatever situation, though various things are changing, since his mind is always occupied with this desire. If his desire is that enthusiastic, he will not fail to fulfill it. So he's really comparing it to all these, you know, worldly desires, right? In the same way, if the aspiration to seek the way is earnest enough, when you practice shikantaza, or with koans, or meet your teacher, Though the aim is high, you will hit the mark. Though it's deep, you will fish it out. Without arousing such aspiration, how can you complete the great matter of the Buddha way, in which birth and death are cut off in a single moment? Yes. Yes.
In the sense, you should have faith that you are right now fully enlightened.
Yeah.
No delusions. Mm-hmm. Nothing lacking. And then he goes on to say that those who practice, that's the essential. And that those who practice in that way,
we maybe could combine those two and say, like, the aspiration to arouse the faith, which Dogen says in what we chanted before the talk, right? I vow throughout countless lives to let go of all doubt about to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith. So he's saying, he's making an aspiration to let go of doubt and discover faith. And that from that, we then that's the ground for Shikantaza. Yeah, because you might say, so you could say this is a kind of preliminary, maybe in that teaching, Dogen saying, just have faith that you're Buddha. But we might say, okay, it sounds good, but I don't. And then, well, how can I? Well, just aspire to arouse this faith. So maybe, different people, different times, maybe they sound maybe contradictory, but I don't think they have to be. Aspiration. And it's interesting, aspiration to realize the way, then when you practice just sitting and letting go of everything, you'll hit the mark. So it's something about this non-doing of Shikantaza that's in this case, he's saying, is fueled by this aspiration to realize the way. And maybe it's what keeps us, like, sitting on the seat of, like, yeah, just sit, just let go, drop off body and mind. Oh, but, like, let me go get a cookie first, or whatever, it's been 3 minutes, so it's like, I'm really just going to let go of everything, but then our habit mind comes in, so, no, I have the aspiration, I'm going to sit for a whole 40 minutes. And then through that aspiration and trust, and then we remember after 5 minutes, we remember the trust, or 10 minutes. If I'd gotten up at 3 minutes, I would have forgotten all about the faith that in Buddha nature. And then we just keep going, and then eventually we let go, and like, oh, why was I resisting this? Like, this is so much like more joyful and easeful than eating a cookie even. But without the aspiration, I might not have sat here long enough to remember that. Something like that might be a way to combine.
Picturing aspiration, and then the faith counters the fear of failure, and self-doubt, which says you can't do it. Which you're fighting, your craziness, which is your disorder. But faith actually is something that can cut through that if you really focus on it.
Yeah.
Faith that if I practice my music, my Zen.
Yeah, so we have Hakuin Zenji's tripod of the foundation for practice is great faith. And I think it means the same thing as Dogen, great trust or faith in Buddha nature, that you have this, you already have this clear, open, compassionate mind, and great doubt, which is like, but what, I don't seem to be experiencing it. I have this faith that that's the case, but what's going on here? I'm suffering. I think that's the, and be conscious of that. Maybe something like that is the great doubt, and then great determination, or maybe we could even say aspiration.
Right.
Determination, aspiration, I'm not sure, but those three combined. Yeah, determination. It's easier, huh? It feels less like desire.
It feels like intention, it feels strong. It feels like, for whatever reason in life, you've made this decision to accomplish this, and you're determined to do it. I mean, you're not wishing and hoping, or you're just determined. I'm determined, there's a gospel song, I'm determined to make heaven my home.
Well, we hear all these different words and with different nuances, but I think it could also have a sense of kind of self-centered striving with determination. So, but for you, determination works.
Yeah, it works for me.
You also just reused the word intention, so which is also has a different feel to it, or directing towards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Aspiration has this thing where there's something lacking, something that I don't have that I need to acquire later on to...
I'm less than.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm lacking some way. I need to aspire to acquire something else that's incomplete at this moment.
I think it's interesting how we all hear these words in different ways, and we could look up all the different nuances in the dictionary, but for me, aspiration, maybe because it's close to inspiration and maybe has some sense of spirit, the word spirit is a part of it, I think, that for me that word has worked for me. But I think this is a good example of how you, when using words that have different flavors for different of us. Like seeking for me has a very strong self. I kind of cringe when I read that here. But we use that word way-seeking mind to translate bodhicitta. So it's all how we, can there be a movement, a direction in a certain forward-moving direction that's not self-centered. Dogen says, to arouse such an aspiration, but we might say, to arouse such an intention or motivation? No.
Determination. Yeah.
Or another word is resolve.
Yes.
Think deeply in your heart of the impermanence of the world. It's not a matter of meditating using some provisional method, are fabricating in our head something which doesn't exist. Impermanence is truly the reality right in front of our eyes. We don't need to hear this teaching or find proof in some sutra about impermanence. Born in the morning, dead in the evening. A person we saw yesterday is no longer here today. Nishijima Roshi's gone. Myogen Steve Stuckey's gone. Patrick's father's gone. Just day after day, these are facts we see with our ears and hear with our eyes. Applying this to our own bodies and thinking about the reality of all things, though we expect to live for 70 or 80 years, we die when we must die. So then he goes on to talk about what's really important here, all the things we get caught up in. Let's let go of what's not important and aspire to realize the way. So I think that's interesting too. We might say, well, I don't know about this arousing an aspiration, but what about if we really contemplate impermanence of our own life especially, we might feel that that stirring. That's how I think of it sometimes. It's like really kind of meditating on impermanence, which is a classic way to do this that Dogen recommends too. We start feeling that, like this is so precious and rare and short an opportunity, this life. What? How do I want to do this, really? And then there's this energy. We could maybe even say inspiration. I want to, like, let go now of what's not important and give myself to what is. And there it is, right? It's like, do we call that aspiration? Or do we call this a natural response coming from recognition of impermanence? Doesn't that seem maybe like it's maybe even not so contrived, right? If we don't even try to arouse an aspiration, but we just keep contemplating the impermanence and our own impending death over and over, and then it's like that what I think of as a stirring in our spirit to practice is completely natural, you know. And I think that's how I think of aspiration. And sometimes we can, you know, do it in a little more contrived way, which is also okay. Like because we know that I think when we have this bodhicitta, something like bodhicitta. For those who weren't here yesterday, I found a place where the Dalai Lama says he's talking with great exuberance about bodhicitta, and then he says, "By the way, I just want to let you know that I have no bodhicitta at all, and not even close. But I have a great wish and aspiration to realize bodhicitta." Yeah, that's a lot.
He's not talking about ultimate bodhicitta, or is he?
I think that is a good question, but I think not, because in the passage he's talking about just generating this wish to realize Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings, and that kind of mind. And then he says, that kind of mind, I don't have anything like that.
That kind of mind says those kind of things. Because our eyes see him doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So what he says.
Another thing we might add into this conversation about aspiration and the Dalai Lama is Dogen's Gendo Koan, where he says, when Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand something's missing.
Yeah, I mean, what would we think of the Dalai Lama if he said, "I have bodhicitta"? Ultimately, just talk like that.
Yeah. Zen. Some of the Zen people do talk somewhat more like that, right? I think there's two, and some of the Tibetans do too. So you have these two, and I think it's all skillful means. Sometimes the style is very, very humble, so none of us get arrogant about where we're at, and sometimes it's really exalted to inspire us. Oh, this is really possible. It's almost like this person has total confidence in their realization, which is often very inspiring. Both ways are inspiring to me, different times. And Dogen has both too. Dogen sometimes says, us, you know, lame people in this inferior country, and then sometimes he'll say, you know, that it's it, this is it completely. It's a lot of talking, huh? Time for some one finger Zen.
Tenshin Rishi talks about with Suzuki Rishi also.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you remember that. I think it might be
something like, I'm not a Buddha.
Yeah, or when he first came to practice. practice with them.
Yeah.
Suzuki Roshi said, I'm not enlightened.
Yeah.
And then later on he said, I am Buddha. Suzuki Roshi said that.
Yeah.
And then it's like, alright, this is more
like that.
Yeah, so for him that was more, maybe encouraged him more to hear that somebody's a Buddha, instead of to hear that the Dalai Lama, who's like this you know, spokesperson for bodhicitta, and just like is more compassionate than anyone can think of, is like, doesn't have any bodhicitta. Great. But is that, you know?
He's fooling us.
Skillful means of all words are skillful means. So maybe this whole thing about aspiration is just for us to have this conversation. Thanks, Dogen. We'll check in with you later. May any merit generated from our gathering be spread throughout the universe to touch all suffering beings. May they be free and at ease. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.